From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. By the year 2060, the United States will have no clear racial majority. Both the Hispanic and Asian populations will more than double, and the black population is expected to rise from about 41 million today to about 62 million by 2060, roughly a 50% increase. According to the U.S. Census, this country will become a majority-minority nation for the first time in 2043. Also worth noting when examining racial trends, a 2013 survey by the Pew Research Center finds that fewer than half of all Americans say the country has made substantial progress toward racial equality, and about the same share say that a lot more remains to be done. Blacks are much more downbeat than whites about the pace of progress toward a colorblind society. They're also more likely to say that blacks are treated less fairly than whites by police, the courts, public schools, and other key community institutions. The University of North Carolina at Pembroke is the most racially diverse regional university in the South, according to U.S. News and World Report. This year, UNCW, which quantifies its diversity at 17%, has now hired its first ever chief diversity officer. Cape Fear Community College, which says its student body is 75% white, also has a number of programs in place to expand campus inclusion. On today's Coastline, we'll meet the two people leading those on-campus programs. Kent Guyon is the new chief diversity officer hired by the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Dr. Guyon took the helm of UNCW's Office of Diversity and Inclusion in mid-April. Kent Guyon, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
Also with us today, Travis Korpening is the director of the Nixon Minority Male Leaders Program at Cape Fear Community College. He is also chair of the Diversity Committee at CFCC. Travis Korpening, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think about the effort to expand diversity on local campuses? Is there a particular place in the community that calls for greater inclusion, or do you think the area is doing just fine? Give us a call and tell us what you think at 910-343-1138. You can also reach us by email at coastline@whqr.org. Kent Guyon, why did UNCW create the position of chief diversity officer in the first place?
You know, I think historically there have been efforts to look at the different components of what it takes to make a campus diverse and inclusive, and the efforts were in small pockets in various areas. So there never was a consolidated strategic plan that was the daily job of one person. So a big part of the rationale really supports having a comprehensive strategic plan that's linked to outcomes and other meaningful activities on campus.
Is this something that is a trend nationwide? Do other campuses in the UNC system have diversity offices? Are we sort of right with the times? Are we ahead? Are we lagging?
I think in terms of a chief diversity officer, we are probably right in the middle of the movement within the university system. Many campuses have tried to have roles and responsibilities designated, but few have made the commitment to have an office that really sees that as priority one. But there is a group now that's actually growing within the university system.
Travis Korpening, what are the Nixon Male Minority Leaders? What is that group about at CFCC?
The Nixon Minority Male Leaders program started out and still is the a conduit from the Minority Male Mentoring Program statewide. The program focuses on the retention, graduation, and transferring to four-year colleges for minority males.
And why is there a specific program for that? Do you see minority males coming into the CFCC system and they're lacking skills that white counterparts might have gained along the way? Or
absolutely. Research shows that minority males are at the bottom in terms of transferring to four-year colleges, in terms of being retained. And one of the things that the state recognized was this issue, and they tried to put together a grant or succeeded in putting together a grant that 45 other community colleges throughout North Carolina applied for and received. So it was a recognized issue and one that North Carolina actually took the steps to go ahead and try to address.
And what is the diversity committee at CFCC? What is the point of that body?
It's to increase inclusion and the awareness of diversity on campus, and to give to kind of be the conduit for developing areas where people feel comfortable if in terms of multiculturalism.
Is this about making the 25% that are in the minority comfortable, or is it about expanding awareness and understanding among the 75% of the student body that are currently white?
It's a little bit of both. The purpose is to try and figure out how we can expand upon making the campus, continually making the campus more globally aware, as well as increasing diversity and opportunities for people to learn from each other.
Kent Guyon, when we're talking about diversity, is this largely a conversation about race, or are there other elements of inclusion that are part of this discussion, particularly where UNCW is concerned?
Sure. So I am very glad you brought that up, because the term diversity really has taken on several different connotations and denotations, and really it can be a surrogate for a lot of issues that probably are better addressed as specific issues. So when we think about diversity on our campus, we think about the individuals who have access, the issues of equity, the ability to prepare ourselves and our students to work in a global capacity, the core value of cultural competency, which really bridges all of what we are going to be facing, especially given the numbers that you started off mentioning, as well as looking at ways to develop our own self-awareness of who we are and how we gain our own ability to interact with others. So, you know, part of it will always be centered around race and ethnicity because of our society, and there are other parts that need to be addressed as well.
What are some of those other parts?
So again, I think when you consider the global capacity of any graduate, the moment you get a degree, you will be expected to work with a host of other individuals from different parts of the world who have different personality dynamics, who have different dimensions of their own personal characteristics that you may not have been exposed to much, you know, in whatever experiences you've had. So as broad as personal characteristics can go, religious, geography, you name it, you should have some awareness of that and the ability to understand where you fit and how your viewpoint informs how you interact with others. So it really is this important foundational capacity that I would not want to have a college degree and not have had some ability to learn in that area.
You mentioned access, and I think that term probably has multiple meanings. But a group of more than 60 organizations has filed a complaint with the federal government claiming that Harvard holds higher expectations for its Asian applicants than other minorities. And NPR reports that this coalition is made up of nonprofits including Chinese, Pakistani, and Indian groups, and it claims Harvard uses racial quotas to control the number of Asian Americans on campus. And this is part of what comes along, I think, with the diversity and inclusion conversation. There are fears about affirmative action. And here is what Manhattan Institute senior fellow Jason Riley had to say on the Asian American complaint against Harvard and the future of diversity policies. He's talking with Wall Street Journal correspondent Mary Kissel.
I think this is the future of the affirmative action debate. We often talk about it in terms of white and black or white, black and Hispanic, but much less attention has been given to how these policies impact Asian Americans and whether they contribute to diversity as well. And I think this raises very, very important questions, because what proponents of affirmative action are trying to do are reconcile two things: group preferences and equal treatment of individuals. And Mary, those two things are just irreconcilable.
Totally, irreconcilable.
It's a zero-sum game at these elite schools in terms of the size of the freshman class. And if you are reserving seats for blacks, Hispanics, or whites, you're necessarily disadvantaging other groups like Asians.
But are there benefits to diversity that would justify really hurting
if there are, I mean, there are a lot of proponents who claim there are benefits, but I've never seen anyone quantify these benefits, whether they're accruing to the white population, the Asian population, or the black population.
So what are the benefits then of campus diversity? That was senior fellow Jason Riley from the Manhattan Institute talking about the Asian American complaint against Harvard University. Travis Korpening, what are the benefits of diversity on campus?
I think diversity on campus allows individuals to be more prepared when they are released into the job market. I mean, it's no secret that it's a global market. And one of the things, especially in America, one of the things we are trying to move towards is being more prepared on a global scale in terms of producing people that are ready to work. And that is, I mean, there's no question. That's one of the things that one of the benefits of diversity, you know, whether you want to address it or not, that is one of the things that you need to be exposed to. Now, if you're the one, if you're one of the individuals that, you know, that doesn't believe in, you know, crossing that bridge, then that, you know, that's another issue. But, you know, the writing's on the wall. It's a global market. If you want to be prepared, you're going to have to deal or you know, come into contact and be able to work with individuals that don't look like you, don't speak like you, didn't come from where you came from.
When we come back from the break, I want to hear from Kent Guyon about that issue, what some of the benefits are to promoting diversity on a college campus. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about diversity and inclusion on the campuses of our local institutions of higher education. With us in the studio, Kent Guyon, UNCW's first chief diversity officer, and Travis Korpening, director of CFCC's Nixon Male Minority Leaders. If you have a question, give us a call, 910-343-1138. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and I'm here with Travis Korpening, chair of CFCC's Diversity Committee, and Kent Guyon, UNCW's Diversity Officer. We're talking today about diversity and inclusion on local campuses. Do you see places in the community that could benefit from greater understanding or inclusion? Tell us about it by calling 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. You can also ask a question of our guests and feel free to tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. Kent Guyon, before we went to break, we were talking about the benefits, the quantifiable benefits of diversity on campus. And at Georgia Regents University, which is where you were before you came to UNCW, you first tackled cultural competency training to help people understand the role of diversity inclusion and inclusion. That was primarily a health science campus, and we'll get into why that was important to you in a little while. But what would greater cultural competency contribute to the university here?
Sure. So I see cultural competency as a tool that really enhances your skills, your knowledge, and your ability to interact with in cross-cultural situations. Many of the situations that we are dealing with now are workplace. They are working with clients. And really, anytime you touch a person in terms of your career, there's an opportunity for there to be cultural differences. So having some understanding of how you negotiate those interactions is really becoming more and more critical as we go forward. In the world of healthcare, and I'll just jump there for a second, we can clearly quantify health outcomes that are made better when the healthcare providers have cultural competency training in a very objective way, as well as a subjective feeling of better provision of care from the patient's perspective. So there are many, many ways that it can be quantified and has been quantified, and was the reason it was so critical for our university to undertake that as a goal.
So then tell us a little bit about your background. You're a medical doctor with a fascination around epidemiology.
Yes. So I went to medical school thinking I was going to be a pediatrician. And lo and behold, came this thing called epidemiology that kind of put me on a different track. And that was really understanding the importance of looking at population health issues, whereby changes in policies, changes in procedures, and even changes in the trainings that we do for our healthcare providers make impactful, powerful differences to the health of a community. I'll just remind us of the world before seatbelts and how, you know, a simple change in seatbelts have just saved numerous lives with one policy change as an example. So I've been very interested in population health, and especially when there are disparities in population health, looking at solutions as to how to bridge those divides.
Can you give us an example of how a medical doctor with greater cultural competency might help create a better health outcome for someone than versus someone who didn't have that same training? What sort of real-world example can you give us that way?
Okay. I don't want to get too personal, but I can think of a number of times when an interaction with a patient has two really important elements. One is the technical side of what's being delivered, and the other is how the information is being delivered or the approach. So I can remember a patient who was in need of a transfusion and was very uncomfortable about the situation. That patient actually asked if I would call a relative to speak with that relative about the pros and cons of having that particular procedure done. Because of the trust that was gained and because of my knowledge of understanding, you know, who makes the call sometimes in people's medical decision-making, I was able to talk and have a conversation that probably wouldn't have happened if I wasn't as aware of that person's background through my own experiences. So it all turned out well. But again, that was an important healthcare decision that was brokered through my understanding of that person's cultural background.
So that is a very clear, quantifiable benefit to cultural competency. When you think about taking that practical application to the campus of, say, UNCW or CFCC, what would that mean in a quantifiable way here?
Sure. So there are actually some pretty good examples already. And one that I kind of direct some follow-up to is one that was done by the National Association for Partnerships in Equity. They actually looked at some of the school systems in the Dallas-Fort Worth area where there was a gap between science scores for girls and boys. The only intervention that they did was gender equity training of the teachers. And lo and behold, 2 years afterwards, scores for all children in that district went up just based upon gender equity training, not only for the girls, but for the boy students as well. So again, a mechanism by just understanding and having some capacity to know how to work with different groups resulted in clearly more positive test scores. In thinking about a college campus, there are a number of studies that have shown benefits. And if you look at the data that the Supreme Court uses to justify why diversity is a compelling interest, you can find it. So I'm not quite sure why the gentleman spoke about not having quantifiable data, but a lot of it is out there. There's benefits to critical thinking. There's benefits to more civic engagement, to student leadership opportunities. The business community has long talked about more productive teamwork. We know that you increase your own self-awareness. You're better prepared as a professional, especially in healthcare, but on and on and on. So there are many, many ways that we can quantify it.
Travis Korpening from Cape Fear Community College. Earlier in the program, you touched on the notion that there are challenges facing some minority students that a white student might not be facing. Can you give us an example of what some of those challenges are and what some of the training is that you provide and the support that you provide to minority students?
Well, number one, to answer your question, some of the challenges that arise start from how we're wired as individuals. We're wired to interact with others based off of our experiences. And when you look at the media, when you look at, what's out there in terms of how we interact every day or what we see every day, what we're exposed to every day, a lot of, it's no secret that minority males are at the brunt of a lot of exposure in terms of being at the bottom. If you're talking about jail time, if you're talking about, test scores. So when you're exposed to that on a regular basis and don't have a personal experience with a minority male that is not in those situations, which there are quite a few, then what it does is it skews your personal skew your personal bias one way or the other. And so the result of that is when you interact with a minority male, you may have some bias. And that's not something that I was on recently. Give you an example. I was on a show called Diversity Matters where Denzel Washington was actually referred to by a young older woman, white woman, and she clutched her purse. He referred to her clutching her purse on the elevator when she was next to him. And this is Denzel Washington. So now, having personal experience with someone, can't guarantee that won't happen, but is one of the avenues that could possibly turn that around.
So it's probably a safe speculation that Denzel Washington has a pretty healthy self-esteem, self-image. But what would that kind of body language do to another African-American man who might have been in the elevator with that woman?
Sure. It makes you feel as though, and I've had this conversation, it makes you feel as though there's something wrong with you. You don't fit. You could just be doing any average thing that an average American, would do on a day-to-day basis. But, you're perceived as being, an aggressor or someone that could be, could cause harm to someone else. And that's may not be the case. So it makes you feel as though you don't fit. And so what I try to do through the Nixon Minority Male Leaders Program is teach them that some of these biases are there, but don't use that as an excuse. You can't use that as an excuse. You have to figure out, there's ways of teaching people, making people more aware that, all minority males don't do these things. And that's what I try to do and train these students to understand through the Nixon Minority Male Leaders Program.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about diversity and inclusion on the campuses of local institutions of higher education. With us in the studio today are Kent Guyon, UNCW's first diversity officer, and Travis Korpening, director of the Nixon Male Minority Leaders at Cape Fear Community College. He also chairs CFCC's Diversity Committee. If you have a question or an observation about diversity on campus, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org, and you can tweet us using coastlinehqr. Travis Korpening, going back to that scenario in the elevator, you said that was an older white woman. Is part of the conversation around diversity and inclusion and greater understanding, is that partly generational?
I think it is. I think we are moving, as a society, as two individual university and two individual educational institutions moving in a positive direction. I think it is generational. I think one of the ways that we're going to change that is by those experiences, those personal experiences. If you have someone that you see every day and you interact with every day, no matter what age you are, that, you know, is not the person that you see on, you know, the nightly news, then I think that does change your perception of, you know, the way you see that particular, whether it's race, whether it's LGBTQIA, whether it's, you know, whatever category they're in. So I think the personal experience is the way that we're going to change it. And I think it is generational, but that doesn't mean that it can't be addressed.
And according to 2013 Pew Research, as we mentioned in the intro, there's still a long way to go. Less than half of Americans would say that we are where we need to be on that front. Kent Guyon, when you talk with other staffers at UNCW, what are you hearing about the biggest challenges facing this campus and this community here along those lines?
You know, I think that there are a couple of different themes, specifically on campus, is this whole idea that we haven't had a coordinated, comprehensive effort. Therefore, the movement has been kind of slow and a bit more protracted than we would like. I think the broader community really sees some racial incidents from the past as really anchors to progress. And I think just in general, a lack of leadership towards really wanting to move the community as a whole in a different direction. Those are some of the themes that that I kind of hear. And again, I've only been here for a month, but I think those have been the ones that have kind of come through thus far.
When you're talking about events from the past that have impacted where we are today, which events are you talking about? Are you talking about things as well known as 1898, the coup d'etat that happened? Or are you talking about more individual kinds of interactions?
Sure. Primarily the large ones that have really profoundly impacted the community. The Wilmington 10 comes up, 1898 comes up, et cetera, and so on. And even recently, more of the division in school districts on test performance, that's something that has also come up. You know, even at, you know, grade level 3, you start to see divides that, again, impact the entire community. We want to try to point fingers and really isolate the issue, but it's all of us. It's not just Wilmington, but the things that we do here impact North Carolina, and those impact the rest of the state. So, again, I think it's important to step up to the challenge and really see how we can improve our own circumstances to really make all of the circumstances better.
So now that you're Chief Diversity Officer and you've met Travis Corpening from Cape Fear Community College, are the two of you going to collaborate? What can the two campuses do together on this front?
Oh, we will absolutely collaborate.
Yeah, I think after today, I think that was you know, definitely something that we have to make happen.
And in what ways will you collaborate? What are some of the things you can do as a team?
So, at Georgia Regents, we actually had an African American male initiative that was funded at the state level and also funded by private contributors that looked at many of the not only social but academic elements to increase progression and graduation. So that was one of the, you know, the moment that I saw that as part of your portfolio. I wanted to be sure we touched base on some of the strategies there. I think, again, I believe that the community as a whole really has a vested stake in this. And thinking about a pipeline forward to the highest level, sometimes we talk about access and, you know, we kind of have automatic access to K-12. Then access beyond that really is where we want to ensure we have policies and procedures in place to support, maintain all the way to the highest level so that the, you know, the third graders who may be off track get on track and stay on track until they get PhDs. That's sort of what I see as the ultimate goal, and we have to connect with each other all along the along that pathway.
So you can't view the local institutions of higher education as discrete entities. You're looking at this as a community-wide initiative.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We're all in this together.
See, I mean, yeah.
it's education from day one until the last day, in my opinion.
I think, and that might be the, you know, not the end all be all solution, but that might be, you know, a big part of the solution is to definitely join hands and try to figure out what you can do as two institutions.
And so what are some, obviously you've made the observation that schools, particularly in New Hanover County, this has been quantified by a study done at UNC, I believe it was Chapel Hill, that identified a very high percentage, more than 95% of schools, public schools in New Hanover County as high poverty schools had huge minority populations. And that's part of what you're talking about, Kent Guyon, when you're talking about third graders who aren't doing as well. There's a racial socioeconomic disparity.
That's correct. That's part of the greater narrative. I think that what's tough to do is to really connect all the dots and to really make it a circumstance that is ours. Who is the our? Because I think we want to isolate and point and single out incidents as opposed to thinking of it as our Wilmington. What Wilmington do we want for not only ourselves but for future generations, and really build around that as the goal? But it's comprehensive, and it really takes a lot of different voices at the table with commitment.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about inclusion and diversity on campuses. We're talking with Kent Guyon, UNCW's diversity officer, and Travis Korpening from CFCC's Nixon Male Minority Leaders Program about expanding diversity on campus and creating an environment that's welcoming to everyone. You can ask a question of our guests by calling 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Travis Korpening of CFCC's Nixon Male Minority Leaders and Kent Guyon of UNCW's Diversity Office. We're talking about diversity on campus in the Cape Fear region. If you have a question for our guests today, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. Kent Guyon, you are probably aware that UNCW's track program has suffered through a highly publicized struggle with funding, and supporters of track at UNCW say it's the most diverse athletic program at the school. Do you see it as important to preserve a program like this? And I should say, just by way of a quick update, WECT reported that the Save UNCW Track Facebook page says, as of yesterday, supporters raised almost $227,000. If the group comes within 10% of its goal at $250,000, the track and field program can stay at UNCW for the next school year. 10%, of course, would mean that supporters needed to raise $225,000, but there's no official announcement at this point.
Okay.
Kent Guyon.
So I will fess up to the fact that I was on the track team from age 10 all the way through college. So track is one of those things that's really close to my heart. And you know, the circumstances here are, in general, with any elimination of an athletic program, it's just a nationwide, long-term scenario where, you know, some interesting dynamics of finance, of Title IX legislation, of campus culture are all kind of clashing together. I remember the very first time that I actually was part of a program closing was actually back in the late 90s, and that was when I was at Georgia Southern University. So it's been something that's been going on for quite some time. And it is very unique to each campus, even though there is this, you know, overhauling of how we think about athletics in general. So the track team, I think, is a good example of how the community can rally around a cause. I think, you know, different people got together, and it looks like the goal is going to be met, which I think is a great first step in preserving it.
Absolutely.
I would absolutely question the quality of the program moving forward, because that is as important as having it. So you want the student athletes to have a positive experience. You want them to understand that the student part of student athlete is really the critical part of that. And there, you know, there is an element of diversity that's tagged to that. But again, I think it really has to be parsed out from those other issues so that you don't make closing of a program purely about diversity in and of itself or about race, but about the larger scope of what does it mean to have a quality program, what's the impact financially, what are the decisions, how are they made, and really what's in the best interest of our students. That's where I'll always fall, what's really in the best interest of our students.
Are you suggesting that the quality of the track program isn't where it needs to be?
Well, I was part of a track team. I was actually on track team at North Carolina State, and I think that there is an experience with athletics that if you are competing at a NCAA sanctioned level, you really should have the equipment, the coaching, the training, the competition. All of those areas really need to be carefully thought about. And I don't know a lot about the circumstances here, but I do know that there's some the second phase of saving track is some renovations. So, again, I think that speaks to the fact that it really is comprehensive, and those things need to be attended to as well.
You've said, Kent Guyon, that much of your initial work will be taking a look at the programs that are there, assessing current programs, what's working. What does that mean? Which programs will you be taking a look at?
So I think there are a number of ways to evaluate where a campus is currently in terms of diversity and inclusion. One area that's a really broad area is the campus culture or the campus climate, really seeing what the experience is like from the perspective of faculty, staff, and students in many different areas, because that's one of the dynamics that really plays out in how you experience your life on a campus. So that's one area. I think there's another area that looks at admission, progress, and graduation. And that's really sort of the ultimate outcome of college. And we want to be sure that we're doing what we need to in those areas as well. And I think Travis can really talk about how we do know that there are areas where there are gaps, and we do need to ensure that we fill those gaps. I think the whole area of cultural competency, what are we doing there, and how does it impact the curriculum, and what experiences do students get in a formal way, and how are those evaluated? So that'll be another part that we look at very carefully, just to ensure that when our students do graduate, they are prepared. Again, I think that's becoming more and more an obligation of higher education in general. So, you know, that's one of the areas, along with student progression, along with campus climate, and really, I think, along with policies and procedures that will be part of that whole strategic look at how we're doing.
Travis Korpening with the Diversity Committee at Cape Fear Community College. First of all, who makes up that committee? How many people are on the committee, and who are they?
We currently have about six people. We ask for outside members as well. People are on campus that are interested in diversity. They definitely can come and join in on our meetings. What we're really focusing on is trying to figure out, you know, creative ways of making this something that we focus on as a campus. And I think We're moving in a positive direction doing that. One of the efforts right now we have going on is our film series. Some of the films we've already shown, Dear White People, I don't know if you're familiar with that film. It's a funny name, but, you know, tackles a lot of issues.
Tell us about that film. What's it about?
The film is really about a young woman who's biracial. She's on a college campus, and she really becomes is like her fire is actually about race, actually thrusts her into a leadership role on campus in terms of speaking for the black community, and she has her own radio show. It's funny that I'm on one now, but she has her own radio show, and she. It's called Dear White People. And one of the, you know, the film, I mean, there's a host of issues the film tackles, you know, from, you know, outside of race, from sexual orientation to, stereotypes in general, and so I think that's one of the ways doing things of that nature. And, you know, I think that's one of the ways that we actually tackle this issue is from a formal level, but also from an informal level, opening up channels to allow people to talk about it honestly and, you know, really get how they feel out so that someone can. I had a conversation with a friend of mine once that had no idea that African-American males, a lot of us don't, you know, we don't use razors. I know this is something that sounds so trivial, but a lot of us don't use razors because of our hair texture, you know. And so he worked in diversity. So for him, me telling him that, he was like, wow, you know, you never know what you're going to learn about someone else. It sounds simple, but little things like that can make a difference in terms of knowledge and just having an experience with someone else.
And so when the diversity committee meets, it's
yes.
people representing not just different races, but
absolutely not.
Sexual orientation, people from different religions.
Yes, right? Yes. We don't ask people their sexual orientation or their religion before they join, but we make it open so that people can come and feel a part of the conversation.
And so this film series was part of what the diversity committee put forth.
Yes.
What are some of the other initiatives that the diversity committee is talking about doing on CFCC's campus?
We're working on developing a couple of resources for people on campus so that, you know, you can kind of find out where, for example, we're working on a webpage so that people can find out if they're interested in multicultural events on campus. We have a great international center, and you're interested in what the international center is doing. You can go to that webpage and kind of figure out, you know, what you would like to be involved with. Even in women's studies, they had their own film series. I mean, if you're interested in something of that nature, whatever avenue you decide you want to go to, or you might be interested in, we are planning to be that conduit. And moving forward to be that conduit so that you can find out those things on campus.
Kent Guyon from UNCW, in recognizing that your efforts on campus will have to be part of a broader community push, what are some of the organizations in the community that you plan to connect with?
You know, if I refer back to my prior experience, many of our committees would intentionally have members of K-12, members of nonprofit. We had a large military community in Augusta, so we would have members from the military community. We would interface with the mayor's office. And then just a number of groups that shared our same philosophical opinion about being more inclusive. But those were some of the stakeholders who were typically always at the table. In the planning of our events and different things that we wanted to move forward in the community.
What is the faculty like at UNCW in terms of diverse representation? Are we talking about a mostly white faculty? And if so, is that one of the challenges that you'll be facing when it comes to expanding this initiative?
Sure. So the faculty has been mostly white for really since the genesis of the university, and it is one of the areas that I think there can be a lot of progress. because it's one of the areas that also attracts students. And it's an area that also leads to research and scholarship and different opportunities there as well. So those things all tie together. Having students who can look to mentors who have similar interests is hugely important. I think if we all think back to some of our college experiences, there was probably an individual that really pulled us along and, you know, brought out the best in us. And many of our students are looking for those opportunities, and they find them quite often in the faculty.
What is cluster hiring? And is that a strategy that could be employed at either institution in service of greater inclusion?
Sure. So I've been involved with cluster hiring really on the side a bit. And it's when you look to build capacity in an area around a theme, and that's kind of what generates the cluster. When I was at Georgia Southern, we looked at the cluster of rural health and built a team of researchers, faculty members with that interest. And when you do that, you can leverage that theme as a way to attract individuals with like interest. And if you do it in an area that, you know, has traditionally or currently has a fairly high number of minority faculty opportunities, you can grow the numbers that way.
And so in this case, then, you would look at hiring minorities? That would be the goal at UNCW?
Well, it's one of the strategies in which you can do that. So you can't really pick and choose where people have their interests. But you also know that public health has a greater diversity of professors than, let's say, computer science. So if you do cluster hiring in public health, your opportunities are just expanded to grow minority faculty members in that area. So it really is one of the strategies that has been used in different places as a way to attract and retain faculty members. And you have a cohort of like-minded professors who can help each other with their work. So that's the other benefit.
So we know that there is a part of the population out there, part of the white population, that probably isn't interested in diversity initiatives or greater inclusion. Traditionalists, people who perhaps haven't encountered some of the obstacles that some minorities have. And as author Tim Tyson from Duke University, I think, has said, fish don't know that they're wet. So what would you say to that group of people, the people who don't really even understand the need for a conversation like this? How would you invite them into this?
Well, I think I like that analogy, fish don't know that they're wet. I think you have to look at if you're interested in the community as a whole and the community being fair and the community being, open to difference, then I think you have to look at, you have to find any deficiency and try to address that. So, one of the things that I was watching, if you're familiar with CNN Black in America, one of the things they addressed, and I've seen it in studies, black male, just employment, black males with no jail time, getting hired less than white males with jail time. And so, you know, when you look, and those are, I'm not making it up, I have the studies for that. So when you talk about that, if you're really interested in trying to change the narrative in the community, and then you have to look at things like that and say, okay, what can we do as a community to turn it around?
Kent Guyon, just a few seconds left. Final thought?
You know, I think it's important for us to all try to think about how thoughts get in our heads. And if this is something that you're not a fan of, how did that thought get there? For me, a lot of what we do improves self-awareness, and it makes it better for everyone. So it's always a net sum game.
That's this edition of Coastline. Thanks to our guests, Kent Guyon of UNCW and Travis Korpening of Cape Fear Community College. Thanks to you, our listeners. And join us for next week's Coastline when NPR political analyst Cokie Roberts joins us. We'll pre-record that show, so send in your questions or your fan mail early so we can include it in the show. The email address is coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.